History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and invest a little time into listening as stories from long, long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we proceed down that path, so often we find ourselves inspired by our men and women in uniform. The 94-year-old we get to visit with today has a special connection to a very unique chapter of history that we don't always hear too much about. It's going to be fascinating to explore with 94-year-old Tad Riley of Fairfield, California, a retired Navy pilot whose highest decorations came not from bombs dropped or guns fired, but from some famous photographs he snapped from his RF-8A in October 1962. We'll get to all of that, but as always, we prefer to go back to the beginning. You've lived quite a few places, Tad, but where'd you grow up?
Started out in Kansas, and I was just a little kid in a little Kansas town, and then we moved back to Pennsylvania, and I did the usual things. I went out for sports, but I was never big enough to do much.
When you say, you know, you moved to Pennsylvania, I've talked to a lot of World War II veterans who were a few years older than you, not too much older than you, but they were in Oklahoma, Nebraska, Kansas, and they had to move because of the Dust Bowl, and that's what forced your family to abandon that area?
Yeah, basically, it affected, that probably killed my father eventually. He had bronchitis forever. And he died, he was only 51, so that was a little premature, but he had to get out of the dust.
Well, and what was that like for you as a six-year-old to have your life altered in such a significant way?
Well, I knew when I was younger, when say 4 or 5 years old, I couldn't go more than 10 yards from the back porch because these storms, you never got any warning on them. And my mother, she could look out the window in the kitchen and get me in, and you would have to get out and close up the house. And one time I went to kindergarten just a block from home, and I had to spend the night. They wouldn't let us go home. A storm hit, and they had blankets and things. We all slept on the floor.
Yeah, most of us can't even imagine a scenario like that. Another thing that comes to mind, since I know you're an extremely accomplished pilot and you've flown all kinds of different aircraft, do you go back to childhood to a moment where kind of that aviation bug was sparked for you?
Oh, yeah. There used to be, they weren't crop dusters, but bum pilots coming through with, I guess they were Jennies, and my father was always interested in aviation, so whenever there was an airport, we were near it.
The old Barnstormers?
Yeah, I guess that's it. I remember they had a red Ford tri-motor, and they'd land it out in a pasture and give rides.
So how old were you think, the first time you went up in an airplane?
Oh, I didn't go up. I was probably 12, 14. It was in a Fairchild at Atlanta Municipal. Went around about a 20-minute ride.
Were you hooked right there and then?
Oh, I'd already been hooked. I've been always making models, and so I've been hooked all the way. That's what got me in the Navy.
Well, I want to hear about that, but I'm also interested in this life as the son of a football coach. I guess your dad was quite the football coach?
Yeah, but I only weighed about 120 pounds, so I wasn't... He didn't have to worry about playing me whether I could or not. Uh-huh. I was a pretty good runner for sprints and track, but I was on the traveling team, but I was never on the first team.
But you told me your father was the coach at Fort Hays State there in Kansas, and he actually beat Oklahoma A&M, which is now Oklahoma State.
I won't say it was one of the Oklahoma schools. You know, just like now, the big schemes schedule some little team to practice on in the beginning of the year, and much to everybody's amazement, Fort Hays beat him. That got him a good job in the East.
Which led to you being a high school friend of a name that football fans might recognize.
Lamar Hunt. He was a classmate of mine in prep school.
Did you have any inclination that he may be a Pro Football Hall of Famer and own the Kansas City Chiefs and all of that?
No, not at that time. That came along later. He wasn't very big, so he was kind of handicapped like I was when it came to playing himself.
What kind of guy was he way back then?
He was just a good old boy. You wouldn't know he could buy and sell half the country at the time.
Did that make you a Chiefs fan?
Well, that was before this. Chiefs came along, and I was in the Navy when that came along, so I didn't really get interested until after I got out.
Yeah, I was just curious if that connection made you pull for them as opposed to another team.
I always root for them now, and of course, I had a Kansas background. Of course, they were more Missouri than they are Kansas City, I think. But
well, and, you know, something else happened during these growing up years, so you've been exposed to aviation, you're dreaming about being a pilot, but you weren't too old when the world changed a little bit. Anytime I meet someone who was alive during World War II, I'm curious to know December 7th, 1941, if you have a memory of how you found out what happened out at Pearl Harbor.
Well, I was at a friend's house and we were playing touch football in the backyard. And I was 11 years old and his mother came out and said Pearl Harbor had been bombed by the Japanese. No one knew where it was. Literally, we had no idea where Pearl Harbor was.
And at that time you were in Pennsylvania?
Yes, in Pottstown, Pennsylvania.
So did you see your hometown changing after that, during those war years? What did you observe?
My father went to the Navy hired a lot of coaches to get aviation cadets up physically qualified. And so he was in a year after Pearl Harbor, it was the next Christmas, he was sent to Georgia Pre-Flight School, and he was on the football staff there with a lot of, they were, all football coaches were in these pre-flight schools at that time.
Yeah, those were some of the best football teams in the country during that era, were the military teams.
Well, there's Matty Bell, he had SMU. SMU was a big power then, it's not now, but Bernie Bierman and people like that, we'd have them in the house for dinner.
So were you starting to think that the military may be in your future, or are there some other things that you remember about those World War II years and how you experienced it?
Well, then later he was stationed at a little air station in Florida, Melbourne, Florida, and it was a substation from Banana River Naval Air Station, which is now Kennedy. At that time it was a PBM base.
Now this is where they launched the space shuttle or all the rockets and all that?
Yeah, well, that's all. At that time, it was little Navy fields up and down the Florida coast.
Well, so you were kind of marinating in naval aviation then, huh?
Yeah, he was stationed at a F-6F Hellcat night fighter training base. And so that was right at the end of the war.
And do you remember that being a big deal when the war ended and what that meant for you and the rest of the country?
Yeah, he gave me the keys of the car and said, take it down, fill it up. We hadn't done that for 4 years.
You know, and that's something I spend so much time talking to guys who were fighting in World War II. Sometimes we forget about what it was like on the home front. Were there things that you had to do without or sacrifice because you knew what was going on?
Well, I don't think so. But you, for instance, you, when you finish your toothpaste, they were in tinfoil, and you had to turn in an empty one to get a full one, and that sort of thing. And of course, I think we had an 8 sticker for rationing for gas for the car, and I think it was 2 gallons a week or 2 gallons a month, maybe. Because we had a stick that we could mark and put down in the gas tank and see if there's enough to go to church. If it got wet, we could go to church.
See, this is the perspective that we wouldn't have without you telling us something like that. So VJ Day happens and he says, hey, we're living high on the hog, go fill her up.
Well, that's about it. And then you could just go down and buy things. All of a sudden, you could buy anything you wanted to. But it was always meat rationing and butter and that sort of thing. You could always get chicken and fish if there was fish available, but you had to be, there was nothing frozen. There's no such thing as frozen food, so it was all seasonal. And you never saw some of those foods except during the season.
I guess I ought to ask, too, did you have any friends or family members who were serving in the war or that you were writing letters to or praying for or thinking about?
Well, I had an uncle that was in the Army, and he was enlisted, but he was in D-Day plus three, and he walked all the way to Berlin, and he ended up first lieutenant. He had a battlefield promotion. He brought me a little Luger, which somebody stole.
You just answered my next question. Do you still have it? Nope, somebody else pocketed that. So how about you? How did you become a Navy man?
Well, my father was in during the war, and in my generation, the draft, everybody was, you wanted to pick your poison, and I looked better in blue.
So how old were you when you enlisted?
Well, I guess, when I went to college, I was, 18, I guess.
So you did ROTC, and where was that?
At University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. That was when it was a football powerhouse. We had Charlie Justice, Choo-Choo Justice.
Long before Dean Smith, huh?
Yeah, Snavely was a coach in those days.
And you already had it in mind that you were going to be a naval aviator?
Well, I always wanted to fly, and that was the best way to do it. I was never interested in the airlines. My experience through my father was they were carrier airplanes, and that's why I wanted to fly off a carrier.
And while you're in college, if I'm doing the math, while you're there at the University of North Carolina, all of a sudden this war breaks out in Korea. Did that change things for you at all, or heighten your sense of urgency?
Well, a little bit. That started in the summer, and we were on. We always had to go on active duty in the summer, and I was at the 5th amphib base in Virginia, and they called us in and said, "Don't make any long plans. You may not be going back to school." That got our attention. But as it turned out, we just finished and went on our way. It didn't really affect us.
And the timing of that worked out all right for you, huh? Right about when you wrapped up school, that war was paused?
Well, no, the war was going on. And I was graduating, and I had orders on a transport ship to go to Thule, Greenland. They were building a base up there. And it was going to be a barrack ship for heavy equipment operators. And that didn't sound too exciting. And they were, at that time, we had to serve 2 years active duty before we could apply for flight training. Well, they called me in and said, "Well, we need more students, and we have an opening in Pensacola now." Well, it was in the fall. That was the hard decision to make, whether to go to Greenland or to Florida. So I went to Florida and went through flight training, and that took about 18 months, and the war was over.
So the first Navy aircraft that you got to fly in, what was that?
SNJ. Air Force called them AT-6s. It was a tail dragger prop, and no power, and a big cockpit, and I was little. That was always a problem, reaching the pedals and so forth. You had to wear special pillows in the back to get you up where you could see.
And so that was the first one. How many military aircraft did you end up flying in your career?
Oh, 18 or 20, I guess. I've never counted them. But before I got out, I was in a ferry squadron. You were supposed to be able to be qualified in six different kinds. And I was qualified to ferry 10 airplanes. And that means I didn't have to operate everything. All I had to do was be able to take off and deliver it someplace. So I got to fly a lot of things, including helicopters that way. I never really operated helicopters. I just flew them cross country. But that's always a thrill. That was one of my top moments, going coast to coast in a helicopter. That's 200 miles at a piece.
Yeah, not too many people have done that. And I guess, I don't know if you can choose a favorite, but I can't help but ask, if you've flown that many different aircraft, fixed wing and, you know, rotating, is there one that you just really loved flying?
Well, the Crusader. That was the hot rod, and it could do everything faster and longer than anything else at the time. It's pretty tame now, but at the time it was the hottest thing going.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we'll hear about some of Tad Riley's adventures in the cockpit of his RF-8 Crusader, including a run-in with a couple of MiGs and the role he and his unit played in preventing World War III more than 60 years ago. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.